At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Coming up on the program today, a business deal gone bad, a macroeconomic deal made. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today the 14th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Were this radio program a New York City tabloid newspaper, our headline today would be Bezos to City, Drop Dead. Or perhaps something printable in New York, but upon which the Federal Communications Commission would frown were I to say it on the radio. Point being, Amazon and New York City on this Valentine's Day are Splitsville. The company announced today that the half of its second headquarters that was to be built in New York won't be. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has been on the Amazon story for us since the beginning. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
So this HQ2 thing was a story for a year, a little bit more. There have been rumors of it falling apart perhaps for a couple of weeks. What happened in the end, do you think?
You know, the short answer is that Amazon probably thought it'd be welcomed with open arms in New York, and then the details of this deal became public, and that did not happen. Civic groups, local politicians, they were worried about the impact this would have on the housing market, also on local infrastructure, public transit. Mm-hmm. And they said a company of Amazon's size, it's like $800 billion in market cap, that it doesn't need this kind of incentive to build a new campus. I think there is something else to point out here, though, that there's been a lot of talk about this being a backroom deal between a few politicians and this enormous company. That's true, but it's also really common. It happens all the time with corporate tax incentives. It's just that in this case, it was a big public spectacle that Amazon held this 14-month-long competition. So all eyes were on the company, and so people were aware of it.
Right, and paying attention. Much has been made of the $3 billion in tax advantages that the company was going to get. Talk to me now, though, about the economic benefit, the upside for New York City and the environment there, the surrounding environment there, that is now not going to happen.
Yeah, the state estimated that Amazon, or that the deal would bring in $28 billion in additional tax revenue over 25 years.
Wow.
And up to 40,000 jobs that paid $150,000 a year on average. Also, it wasn't like Amazon could just take this $3 billion and not create the jobs. The incentives, for the most part, they were tied to actual job creation numbers. So there were plenty of people who did want Amazon to come, despite the backlash. Many of them were business owners, too, who are disappointed now that it's not happening.
Yeah. Important to note here, I think, that Amazon still does have plenty of people working in New York City. And yes, to some degree, you have to have a presence there. But one does wonder what other companies who are thinking about making big investments in New York City are going to say now.
Yeah, I think it shows that if you come to New York, there are a lot of constituencies that you have to deal with. It is a big, congested city. The public transit leaves something to be desired. And the housing market, like, prices are high. And so people, if you are a company who's gonna locate here, and you might make those problems worse. You're going to have different civic groups to deal with.
Yeah, super quick. What are the there were like 20 runners up in this competition. What are the odds that in like 6 months we see Amazon say, "Oh, hello Chicago," or "Hello Atlanta"?
That definitely it could happen. For now, yeah. Amazon though has said that it's not looking for another HQ2. It's going to move ahead with Virginia and another location in Nashville. Maybe the jobs will get split up between those. Okay. Who knows?
Fair enough. Marketplace Mario Segarra in New York on that Amazon story for us today. Thanks.
Thanks.
All right. Talk to you soon. There is news of the politics of the American economy today.
I've just had an opportunity to speak with President Trump, and he, I would say to all my colleagues, has indicated he's prepared to sign the bill. He will also be issuing a national emergency declaration at the same time.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell there, of course, confirming the conventional wisdom of what was pretty much always going to happen with the wall and the prospect of a second government shutdown. Said Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, we will review our options. In a not unrelated story, the Commerce Department released retail sales numbers for December this morning. They were late, like a month late because of the shutdown, and they were not pleasant. Retail sales off 1.2% in December from a month earlier. Since economists had actually been expecting a small increase, we asked Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson to figure out what gives.
These numbers are actually so surprising, some analysts and economists think there might be something kind of funny going on with the data. Joe Minarek is the director of research at the Committee for Economic Development.
My instinct would tell me that what we're seeing in this report is about two-thirds statistical noise, perhaps one-third substantive issues.
The noise and those substantive issues, Minarek says the government shutdown might have played a role in both.
The shutdown could spook consumers who think that it has implications for their own short-term financial futures.
Plus, it might have impacted the collection of retail sales information. There's one piece of the report that's especially confusing for Joel Bynes, who runs the retail practice at Alex Partners, a consulting firm. Online sales declined almost 4% from November to December, but Amazon had a strong fourth quarter.
And they represent roughly half of the e-commerce sales. I can't get the math to work.
But Bynes says the data does contain a lesson about uncertainty, which there was a lot of at the end of the year, from the shutdown to the stock markets.
I don't think that this is a signal that the economy has flipped and we are, you know, headed for some sort of a consumer pullback or a consumer crash. But I do think it's a signal that the consumer is very cautious right now.
Maybe so cautious they held off on that last trip to the mall or that extra gift. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
More Tracy on the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow, by the way. A think piece on what this economy would look like if we all worked four-day weeks. Also, and unrelated, I'm off tomorrow. Traders on this Thursday, I had a little bit of agita. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's news in the cryptocurrency space today, news of a sort. It comes from JP Morgan, which said this morning it has finished testing something called the JPM coin. Lest you think, however, this is the biggest Wall Street bank getting deep into tradable crypto, it is not. Michelle Davis covers finance for Bloomberg News. She wrote about the story today on JPM coin. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So just because this whole cryptocurrency thing gets complicated, what exactly is the JPM coin? Because it's not Bitcoin, right?
That's correct. It's not Bitcoin. JPM coin is basically JP Morgan's solution to this problem of transferring large amounts of money between companies. So it's their own coin that's going to facilitate, you know, if Apple wants to send money to, you know, a client in Europe.
And is that a problem for JP Morgan? I mean, what's the actual technical problem they're trying to solve?
So a big part of JP Morgan's business that not a lot of people know about is that they move more than $5 trillion in wholesale payments every day. Hmm. And right now, the way that they do it is using SWIFT, which at times, because of, you know, cutoff dates, depending on what country institutions are in, means that payments aren't always real time. It's clunky. It's on the wire.
SWIFT is the internationally recognized standard. That's just kind of the means by which it happens now.
Right. It's the air traffic control system for sending money around the world.
Got it. Okay. And the challenge here now is that J.P. Morgan, as you were just starting to say before I cut you off, they want to be able to do it in real time, like handing somebody cash, in effect?
Right. They want value to be able to transfer instantly. Because why not?
Yeah. No, well, why not? It makes sense. Not to get too weedy here, but this JPM coin will be, first of all, not traded publicly. You can't buy and sell them. And also, it's pegged to the dollar. So every JPM coin is backed by a dollar that J.P. Morgan has in the bank, so to speak, which is how they make it work, right? They'll transfer their dollars to their dollars and then J.P. Morgan coins to J.P. Morgan coins.
Exactly. So this isn't a betting mechanism in the way that right. Bitcoin is. It's just a tool to simplify this, you know, money transfer process.
It's interesting because it's kind of a glimpse into the gears, the machinery of the global economy. I mean, if J.P. Morgan transfers $5 trillion a day, right, it's that's
a
whole
lot. Yeah, that's just wholesale payments.
Yeah, right, exactly. A word here about J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon, who has said he's opposed to Bitcoin and called it a fraud. That's not what's going on here, right? They're using the technology underlying cryptocurrencies, blockchain, to make this work.
That's correct. This isn't, necessarily a shift from Jamie or J.P. Morgan at all about crypto or blockchain.
Right. J.P. Morgan is a giant, right? They're not necessarily the first in this space, but this is, do you think this is a tipping point?
You know, it's an interesting question. Today in crypto land, people were debating the significance of this. And some people pointed out, you know, rightly that the technology they've developed here isn't necessarily anything new. It's incremental. And in fact, J.P. Morgan so far has only successfully completed one transfer of money, you know, between one of its accounts and a client. Huh. But being that they are, you know, the biggest U.S. bank, they are this huge institution, the other argument is that having them behind it does lend some credibility to the space and could lead to, you know, more adoption by, mm-hmm. by big institutions.
Any sense of timing on when this becomes an actual viable thing as opposed to, you know, this slow rollout?
They've said that in the next few months, they're going to be testing out these transfers with a small number of clients. Maybe by the end of the year, they'll be ready to announce something more.
Michelle Davis covers finance for Bloomberg. Michelle, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Even before the Amazon news broke today, this was not going to be a great year for New York City's personal income tax revenues. There is an expected drop from last year of almost $1 billion. The state government up in Albany says January personal income tax receipts were down $2.3 billion, and the fingers of blame are being pointed. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
New York City's expected shortfall in income tax is pretty big.
We are projecting that our revenues for personal income tax alone are going down compared to last year by $935 million.
Melanie Hartzog is budget director for New York City. Now, New York's next fiscal year budget is a total of $92 billion, so we aren't talking calamity. But $1 billion is still $1 billion, so what happened?
Some of this was anticipated.
In some ways, of course, New York was going to get less in income tax this year compared to last year, because last year was freakishly good. It was good because some people, wealthy people, paid a lot of state and local taxes early that year, hoping to get ahead of the new federal tax law.
High net worth clients rushed to prepay not only their 2017 income taxes, they also prepaid real estate taxes.
Kenny Lindenbaum is a tax partner at Raich, Endy, Maltern Company. He says clients were rushing to prepay their state and local taxes because they knew it would be the last time they could deduct all that money on their federal tax returns. The new tax law cut those deductions. After the tax law in 2018, people didn't prepay as much.
There was no reason to do so in 2018 because they were limited on the tax deduction.
So New York might actually still get some of this money, just a little later than it expected. But all of that was predictable, says New York City's budget director Hartzog. What was not predictable was this.
December was the worst month for the stock market since the Great Recession. No one could have anticipated that.
A lot of taxpayers, especially at the higher end of the income scale, took losses at the end of the year.
Jared Walczak is a senior policy analyst at the Tax Foundation. High-income taxpayers could use the losses in the market to offset the money they made earlier in the year, lowering their taxes. And this highlights how reliant places like New York City and state are on high-end earners for income taxes at a time of growing income inequality. The highest earning 1% of New York City residents generate 43% of city income taxes. Darian Shansky is professor of law at UC Davis.
Those taxes are going to be sensitive to the economic fate and tax planning decisions of a smaller and smaller number of people.
People whose incomes are often from investments, which can vary dramatically. Kim Rubin is with the Tax Policy Center.
So that means that on the margin, the money that's coming in or not coming in is pretty volatile.
Now, New York City knows this, and it gets revenue from far more than just volatile income taxes. There's sales tax and property taxes, too, which is why, despite the loss of income taxes, the overall city budget is still growing. Budget Director Hartzog.
But again, there's reason for caution concern, and that's why we are being aggressive on savings.
Hartzog says, mindful that volatility can return, the city plans to reduce expenses by $750 million. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And here we are picking up somebody's television that we might be able to put into our store and get $50 for.
Yes, but does it bring you joy? Think about it. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 103 today, 0.4%, 25,000 to 439. The NASDAQ up 6 points, less than 0.1%, 74.26. The S&P 500 down 0.75%, 27.45. As we mentioned, Amazon started to spread the news today. It is not going to locate HQ2 or half of it anyway in New York. Amazon down 1% today. Touched on that December drop-off in retail sales, so some department stores looking a bit shop-worn today. Nordstrom gave back 1.5%. Kohl's slipped 0.7%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.65%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. When you get right down to it, economic nuts and bolts wise, there are few basic functions of the federal government more important than the census, counting up every 10 years how many people live in this country and where. It's a factor in how federal funds are distributed, representation in Congress. It's used at the state level for their spending decisions, a whole lot of stuff. And for the past 230 years, how the Census Bureau does its counting hasn't really changed much. 2020, however, is going to be different. Issy Lepowski wrote in Wired recently about the challenges of taking the 2020 census digital. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe we ought to start with how the census works now, or worked in 2010, I guess, right?
Right. So for more than 200 years, the census has been this pencil and paper activity. You get a questionnaire to your home, you fill it out. If you don't fill it out, somebody's going to come knock on your door and ask you, and they're going to fill it out on a piece of paper. And then all of that's going to get logged. It's a really human intensive, really time intensive process. And that's not even including all the time it takes to log and collect every address that exists in America, which is, of course, the first step to collecting the census.
Well, right. And that's actually the anecdote with which you start this piece, which is a mapping seminar or conference. Tell me about that, and then explain how that rolls into digitizing the 2020 census.
Right. So this is the Esri conference about federal mapping technology.
Right. Esri's a big mapping company, right? A big geo.
Exactly.
Right.
They're a huge mapping company. Federal mapping technology, not typically the most exhilarating topic, but this year it really was exciting. It was interesting because these Census Bureau workers came on stage and they debuted these tools that are going to be deployed for the first time for the census. So on the front end, for the first time ever, the Census Bureau is going to be asking the majority of Americans to answer the census online. Hmm. And then on the back end, which is what those Census Bureau workers were there to debut at this conference, there's going to be a lot of technology going into the collection process and the address list building process. But of course, because it's new technology being deployed for the first time in a really high-stakes environment, there are certainly a lot of risks involved.
Well, there are risks, and I've got some questions. You ready?
Go for it.
Hacking, I mean, and manipulation of data and all of that stuff that we've become so well acquainted with over the past 2 years.
Right. So hacking is obviously a huge concern, and the Census Bureau is not naive about this. They're working with the Department of Homeland Security, and they reiterate over and over that the data that they store is going to be encrypted. So that, you know, brings some comfort to the situation. The problem that cybersecurity experts are concerned with is that my device isn't necessarily the most secure. And so here you're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of potentially corrupted devices and what could happen before my data gets sent to this encrypted, you know, secure server that the Census Bureau is hosting it on.
Exactly. All right. So question number two. I remember back in 2010 when I was looking at a lot of charts and graphs of the unemployment rate, you could actually see in the unemployment rate graphs when the Census Bureau started hiring hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, and it showed up in all that macroeconomic data. I imagine we are not going to need as many census workers, thus fewer census jobs, but also it will be cheaper.
Right. So that is the hope. That was the whole idea behind investing in this technology, is that the expense of conducting the census has really exploded.
Right.
So what they're hoping is that by making people more efficient, they're going to need far fewer of them.
How is it that we're sitting here in 2019 and the Census Bureau is just now, or has just in the past couple of years, I imagine, realize that it needs to get digital? I mean, are they doing this out of the goodness of their own hearts?
Well, I think it's largely driven by funding. Remember, this only happens every 10 years. Remember that it does take money, I guess in this case, to save money, because you have to build the technology in the first place. And there are risks involved. So this isn't something that they want to jump into lightly, especially when the census is something that's really hard to get people to participate in to begin with, at least in the United States.
Right. Issy Lepowski writing at Wired on the challenge. This is the name of the piece. It's a good piece. The challenge of America's first online census. Issy, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Marie Kondo, she of Tidying Up fame, is a thing again. Her Netflix show that you might have heard of, following up on her 2014 best-selling book, Get Rid of Things That Don't Spark Joy, is her catchphrase. And it turns out there is a whole lot of joyless stuff out there. Thrift stores are reporting record-breaking donations. But purges on the scale of what Kondo is talking about can be challenging and expensive for people who live in big cities, because it's not like they can just stick stuff down in the basement or up in the attic, most of them, right? So for city folk who choose to tidy up, where does their stuff go and who pays to get it there? Marketplace's Lila Goldstein reports.
It's nearing midnight, and Rashawn Aways is desperately trying to get rid of a drafting table that retailed for $300. She's struggling to offload it for $65. She's also trying to ditch a shelving unit, two leather armchairs, a wooden table. That's on top of three bags of clothes she's already donated, all inspired by Marie Kondo and an upcoming move.
I was like, okay, this changed my life. I'm doing it. I'm going to follow her method.
But in New York, there's deciding to get rid of something and actually getting rid of it.
I mean, these are huge things, you know? It's not like you can disassemble them and it'll be fine. They won't fit an Uber XL, you know?
A Waze buyer finally shows, almost 2 hours late.
Is it cold?
Extremely.
But he's empty-handed.
Do you have us tools?
He doesn't have tools.
You don't have tools?
She doesn't have tools. So they just stand and look at each other. A Waze starts sifting through drawers and asking the doorman for help.
So we can have the letter L.
Allen key.
Yes.
Yeah, Allen key.
Yeah.
But after some failed attempts with an ill-fitting Allen key...
No.
No?
It's not it.
They decide he'll have to come back another day.
It's kind of tragic.
These tragedies are part of why some New Yorkers end up just trashing things that don't spark joy. Textiles make up 6% of what's sent to landfills from New York City. And the Department of Sanitation says every day its workers pick up items that could have been donated or reused. Leaving stuff on the curb is just so much easier than cramming bags of junk into a packed train and lugging it up subway stairs.
Salvation Army, how may I help you? Yeah, two bags of clothes.
The Salvation Army is among a handful of charities that will actually come and pick up used clothes and even furniture. And it's a huge operation. In a massive Midtown warehouse, there are metal carts filled with donation bags, wooden pallets topped with stacks of TVs, and a row of at least 10 mattresses. A fleet of trucks comes and goes 5 days a week. Fred Muse has been with the Salvation Army for over 30 years.
It is expensive to keep a fleet going and employees and all the wear and tear on the trucks.
20 trucks, 20 paid drivers, plus dispatchers and warehouse staff. Parking tickets alone cost about $3,000 a month.
And here we are picking up somebody's television that we might be able to put into our store and get $50 for.
He says the higher value donations end up making pickups worth it. But some items simply can't be sold at all.
We've gotten caskets, prosthetic limbs. We got ashes one time, somebody's ashes. I just reached over and saw this. You know, this machete. So we get it all.
Yeah, someone donated an actual machete. Other unusables sit on a heap on the loading dock. The Salvation Army has two additional dump trucks just to haul that joyless junk away. I'm Lila Goldstein for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today with a nod to the calendar and the Twitter hashtag FedValentines. And yes, I know this is geeky, but some of these are pretty good. From Neil Kashkari, the president of the Minneapolis Fed and a noted inflation dove, that is to say he is not all that worried right now about inflation in this economy. There is this one. Roses are red, blah, 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 blah. There's still slack in the labor market. And it's pretty funny, and I can't believe I laughed at that. Also, this one from the Chicago Fed last year. Valentine, when we're apart, my interest rate goes off the chart. I mean, come on, right? All right, we got to go. The Dow off 103 today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 6 points, less than a 0.1%. S&P 500 down 7 points, about a 0.25%. Amir Bibawe, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.